Welcome, everybody. This is class two in the pelvic principles class. We're going through our B sequence today, and people are still filing in. We got the team all in place doing an amazing job of running the whole thing in the background. Huge thanks to Tiffany, who's been working hard to keep the recordings going, to get you the access you need. Thanks to Carmen and everybody else who's been chatting in the forum about the help you need. It always takes a little bit of orientation. We're ironing out a few wrinkles too, so I think thanks for your patience as we get that going as well. All right, so I'm just going to go ahead and pull up my presentation there. And again, if you have questions, just chat them into the chat box or save them for when we do our Q&A period there. Okay. Lorene, how's that looking? You got my screen up on your screen there, Lorene? You have a slideshow up there?
Yep, you look good.
Yay, here we go. So just another shout out to Kiva. It's something to go check out. They are a micro lending organization. There's a lot of people getting help from them now, both in this country and beyond. It's a place you can take an interest-free loan. You can apply for that, and it's people funding people. And I've myself have funded a bunch of things going on there, so I really recommend it. We even have a little team we're trying out. It's micro team. We just started it, but if you want to come join us and be on our lending team and see what people are doing, the help they're getting, it's bit.ly/kiva-hands-on, and I'll put this on the Facebook group too. It's such an interesting experiment, the way we're helping each other and supporting each other through these times. Just a few reminders too about getting the most out of this kind of environment. The big one is avoiding multitasking, huh? Doing just this. So let the email go, let the texting go, etc. Engage your body. This is what we have to do on purpose, since it's not a necessarily embodied medium. We don't get to touch each other. We are going to move a little bit, but mostly it's up to you to stay comfortable and move around and stuff like that as we go. Engage your mind. Write down your questions, et cetera. Keep track of what you want to know. Put it in the chat. We'll have a couple breaks throughout the course. It's more, even more at the end where you can ask your questions, et cetera. And then save them for your small group meetings. I got great reports back on the small group meetings overall. What an interesting experiment to be figuring out how to engage with you and be sharing this material. And so far, so good. Lots of great feedback and great suggestions as well. I want to start with you standing up. You're going to stand up, and we're going to do this one together. This is how we start our B sequence in the pelvis, hip, and sacrum workshop. So take a little time to stand up, and you want to see yourself in the frame. I'm actually gonna stop my screen share, and I think I can even spotlight myself so that you got me on your screen. Yeah, because what you wanna do is you wanna get someplace where you can see yourself, and sorry for the flashing hand beside me, and then you're gonna walk over to the edge of your screen. You're gonna walk over to the edge of your screen. So you see how I walked over the edge of my screen? That's gonna be the vertical indicator for you. And if you can, you wanna be able to see both your hips and your shoulders. So yeah, you gotta mess around with it so you can see yourself. And then I'm gonna unspotlight myself so that you can see your own picture. Yeah, in theory, this is how it works. Now, you may be able to see yourself, but in any case, what you wanna do is raise the leg that's in the middle, toward the middle of the screen. So what that does is that allows you to shift your center of gravity over the standing leg. So you're all the way to one edge of the screen. You're going to raise the leg that's toward the center of the screen. And then you got to shift your weight over the standing leg. So you essentially move even closer toward the edge of your screen. Adjust that around until you can see how when you lift your leg, you actually do get closer to the edge of your screen. Yeah. If you're really good at Zoom, you can actually pin your own video so that no matter who's talking, you stay there. You may have other ways of doing that too. Don't worry about that too much. But if you're watching me, I'll try to exaggerate the pattern there. So when I'm going to go back to spotlighting my video. So sorry, it's going to take over your screen for a second. What that means is when I lift that leg that's toward the center of the screen, my weight shifts this way toward my left in this case. And the thing I want to check in this test is, do my shoulders shift more or do my hips shift more? There's basically two ways to get over that standing leg. One is to move the upper center of gravity and the other is to move the lower center of gravity. Yeah, it's fun to watch the gallery and you can switch that too, I think, so you can see everybody playing with that. But basically the question for you is, are you shifting your shoulders over your standing foot? Or are you shifting your hips over the center foot? Shoulders, that's me mocking up shoulders. Hips, that's mocking up hips. Get an answer for yourself on that side and then scooch on over to the other edge of your screen. So you got a vertical indicator there. And now you're gonna lift the other leg, the leg toward the center of the screen, and you're gonna, the edge of the screen will tell you, do your shoulders hit the edge of the screen first or do your hips hit the edge of the screen first? Yeah, if your whole trunk moves evenly and your arm touches the edge of the screen, that's even. That's like everything Bhavina wants. We're gonna call that more of a hip response as opposed to the other one where my shoulders really get over there and bump that edge of the screen clearly first before anything else. All right, play with that for a minute or two so that you get a sense of yourself, your own pattern. Yeah, and then when you're done, we'll go have a seat and let's talk about what that means. Talk about what that means.
Phil, we do have a question from Brian.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
You know, Nikki, we're going to wait on questions. If we can. Brian, chat into the chat. And moderators, if you think it's something that to jump in with, go ahead. But otherwise, we're going to wait on questions for now. So back to sharing the screen. Here we go. So that's it's the Stork test. That's what we just did. We're looking at the shift. There's my lovely wife, Loretta. And it's all written out there. I'm not going to bore you with trying to read it there. It's in the class handouts. It's in the manual that goes with the DVD at all. But basically, the short story is when you stand on one leg, you got to get your weight over it somehow. And you can either do it with your shoulders or you can do it with your hips. When you do it with your hips, you smile. When you do it with your shoulders, you might smile there too. But basically, this is probably a more stable situation. It's not like necessarily one is good and one is bad. In fact, you'll see there's big variations in people. But what we're looking for in our sequence here is the capacity to get your lower center of gravity over the standing leg. And that involves a few things that we'll go through piece by piece. I'm going to give you some of the anatomy now. And I just do want to give you a little heads up that it's been approved for all audiences, but there is some maybe PG-ish kind of material in here, some anatomically explicit pictures of human nudity. So you have been warned, like this one. This is a cross-section of the human body, and you might be able to place it. It's right at the top of the femurs. So here are femurs, yeah. Here are the outer layers of the glutes and the legs. Here's male genitalia, et cetera. Here are hamstrings and glutes. It's in back. And this, if you're familiar with Lisa Nilsson, you know her work as a paper quiller. She makes careful little reconstructions of anatomical cross sections with rolled paper, which for those of us into layers and wrappings is totally cool because she's basically building up these structures through layers and wrappings, a lot like the body does with its fascial layers, etc. So our goals are for abductor and adductor release with weight shift. So when we shift the weight, we want those two things to release. Now I'm just going to review our definition of release. Release means it could be an eccentrically lengthen. In other words, lengthen under load and maintain control. It could mean relax. Yeah. It could mean soften. It doesn't mean unbuckle. It doesn't mean pull apart, probably. Maybe, you know, that's under debate. But we're talking about an effective release and a change in its length under control. We're also looking for leg-pelvis differentiation today. We want those things to move separately. That's a word we use a lot in our series. Differentiation basically meaning freedom of one thing from another, making things distinct or different from one another. And we want, in this case, the leg to move freely from the pelvis. The obturator internus, we had a little faculty strain going last night trying to find the right word for this blank. And I'm not sure what it is yet. We had some great candidates. I don't have the list here for you. Larry had the best idea. He suggested we give it to you guys as homework to see if you know, what blank you would put in there after you see the sequence and you see the lecture. The obturator internus, after that big buildup, you know, we're still going to call it release. We're still going to call it eccentric control. But then that concept of how do we describe this thing we're after for with the pelvic floor, I settled on awareness. Now that could include an awareness in space. We want our clients to be effectively more aware of their pelvic floor as they move and as they stand. Or it could be an awakening was one of the suggestions to it, or enlivening, or waking it up. It's probably not in most cases released. There might be some people where that ability to relax is what we need. But it's more like we want the full range of relaxation and contractile possibility, but especially an increase in awareness and the proprioceptive sense of that part of the body. And then just a reminder of our primary goals of options for movement and refined proprioception, what seems to happen is not only does that help with coordination and movement, but it helps quite a bit if there are pain or other kinds of conditions going on there that involve that part of the body. So our indications for today's sequence, low back pain. A lot of these things, you're going to see we're not going to work directly with the low back. Maybe at the end of the sequence, we get into the psoas a little bit. But a lot of these things set the stage for the back to be uncomfortable and unhappy. Gait, walking, and balance limitations, because this little test we just did of getting up toward the end of the screen and seeing did our shoulders hit first or did our hip hit first, that's a balance question. And it's especially interesting, I didn't have you do this, but you can imagine with the client, especially interesting when you have a client do it both directions. And often you'll see differences left and right, and helping someone have the full range of option there really can improve someone's balance and stability. Number 8 is pelvic floor issues. And there's a long list of those. A partial list here, incontinence retention issues, basically urinary issues, pre-postpartum, getting ready for birth, but also recovering from, after having given birth, prostate conditions, including prostate infections, but of course, prostate surgery in guys. And a lot of people's low back pain responds really directly and really obviously when the pelvic floor awareness or alivened feeling is increased. All right. So now's a little moment for, we can take a little Q&A as you fill this in. What questions are out there so far?
Brian has a couple questions still. Want to unmute him?
You want to read those? You got them chatted in or you want to? Let me see. I don't have that control here. So, Nikki, yeah. Can you read those to me?
Yes, I can. In relationship to the Stork test, mm-hmm. It's if your hips are strong, there should be no shifting? ?
We want the ability to get over the standing foot. We want the ability to get the pelvis over the standing foot. And strength is a factor, but especially that eccentric release under load, ability to get the hips over the foot. Yeah. What other question was there?
We have one from Audrey Wong and Andy Deal. Can you expand on the concepts of adductor and adductor release?
Yeah, that's what I'm going to do in this lecture. Exactly. I'm going to explain what that all means. Yep. What I've said so far is that we want them to be able to lengthen under load and have some control, to be able to relax and contract, and especially that eccentric phase to be able to get along. But I'll show some pictures and explain that more. Good with that. Any other hands up?
And we have one more from David Till.
Okay. I think Claire, are you our hand manager there? Claire,
I am, but I can't see any hands up at the moment.
Okay, great. That's even more. You got one more question, Nikki, in the chat? Go right ahead.
Yep, one from David. Will we be covering pubic synthesis distortions?
We talked about that some in our small group. I'm gonna punt on that question. I guess the answer is no, but eventually for sure, and keep that question for maybe the end of this lecture, and we can go into it more as time allows. But it's not the primary focus today, and I got some things to say about it though that I wanna say for the right time, which is probably more the end of today. All right, so onward now with our show. Just to review the motions of the hip joint, we were working with these last sequence, flexion and extension here. And here is abduction and adduction at the hip joint, external rotation, internal rotation. And if you remember, we did various combinations of these in the push-broom sequence and in sequence A. I'm just gonna let you watch that for a second. Internal rotation, etc. Flexion. There's quite a bit more flexion than there is extension, but we want some of both. That abduction, bringing the leg out to the side, and adduction toward the center, also important movements. And then the rotation happens right around that femoral head and in the acetabulum. Okay, so those are our movements. And then go ahead, if you would, and enter in the chat box. Oh, there it is, good. Yeah, I'll start it again. Enter into your chat box. Well, no, I'm sorry, I'm trying to get the slide to advance. There we go. Enter into the chat box what that motion is. Type it into the chat box, if you would. What motion is that? So it's that something else. And Nikki, if you wanna read those out to me. What are people saying that is? That femur is doing something. What is it?
Sorry. Circumduction.
Yeah.
Walking.
Yes. There you go. Someone's been in the class before.
Yeah. Salsa dancing.
Nice. When we walk, it's not true circumduction, as you can tell. This is trying to model what happens at that joint when we walk. In other words, when we step through, there actually is a combination of all these movements. In this view, the pelvis is held artificially still, like the camera's focused on the pelvis, and it's just showing the movements of the femur that are happening below the pelvis when we walk. So there is flexion and extension, for sure. But the surprise to a lot of people is how much abduction, adduction there is. That's variable, of course, individual to individual, even side to side. But that's the important one we want to make sure is there. And that's what allows the hip shift over the standing leg. Now, the purpose of the sequence here isn't just to make the stork test easier, of course, it's to make walking and balance easier. So in that joint, in walking and in balance, we want all these motions, particularly abduction, adduction, so we can get that hip right over the standing foot. Okay, John Wayne did that with his shoulders, you know, more often than not. He did all kinds of things. He actually has a really complicated and interesting walk if you analyze it, both for its cultural and gender-based connotations, but also for its biomechanics. So he's getting, in this picture here, he's getting his shoulder girdle pretty clearly over the standing leg. So he's, you know, getting ready to do something with his gun, who knows, but he's getting his center of gravity over the support. So he's a shoulder shifter in this picture. By contrast, no, I'm sorry, we're not ready for the contrast yet. We're going to watch him just walk. So you have to amplify it a little bit in your mind's eye. It might be jerky over the internet connection, but he's essentially shifting his shoulders over each foot as he walks. And there's a bunch of theories or stories or myths maybe about why he had such a distinctive walk. One of the most interesting was someone claims that he had size 6 feet, which is really small if you're, you know, international. Size 6 U.S. shoes are really small for a guy. But that he also had a 2-inch lift. That's pretty well established. I don't know what size his feet were, but he did wear a lift in his shoes a lot to appear taller. So if that's true, that he had really small feet and he had a lift and was tall, he was teetering a little bit. He was doing a lot with his upper girdle to stay balanced over those feet. And that's what people do when they don't have control of their hip as well. Control of the abductors, say, and adductors. When you've had a replacement, when you have a prosthesis, you don't have the same muscular control over that. So you balance by getting your upper center of gravity over the supporting limb. Here's Sarah Reinerston, a triathlete and model and proponent of differently abled rights. Here she is in a triathlon in Hawaii, but she's pretty clearly showing us how she uses her upper body to get over that standing leg. She was cool. I found these pictures of her and thought these are great illustrations of what I'm trying to explain. So I forget where it was, one of her social media accounts. I just, you know, messaged her and says, "Hey, there's a couple pictures. I'm teaching a class. Do you mind if I use them?" She's like, "Totally. Send me something about the class. I want to know about it." So it was great to have that little bit of blessing from her to go use the work she's put into herself. She's an amazing athlete and, you know, just someone that's really done a lot in her life and is doing it publicly in a way that's supporting all of us in a sense. But she's really getting her shoulders over the standing leg as opposed to the other pattern, which here Marilyn Monroe is showing us, where you're getting the hip over the standing leg. So let's go back. Sarah's getting her shoulders over the standing leg. Yeah. Marilyn's getting her hip over the standing leg. So there's two different ways to balance it. Marilyn's story, again, some of the stories around her hip shift. This is one that Eric Dalton told me, who had an indirect connection to hers by living in her apartment in Malibu after she was gone. But he basically rented the same apartment that she'd lived in at one point in Malibu. But his story was that she worked a lot on her hip shift. She wanted a really exaggerated hip shift and modeled it after Mae West, an old American film star. And when she didn't have the range she wanted, what she did is she broke the heel off of one of her high heel shoes and used that difference in support heights to throw her hip out even more in the way it wasn't going until the joint capsule loosened up and her body accommodated that. And then went back and forth, you know, taking the heels off in her shoes until she got the walk she wanted. So here she is. After I showed that picture one time, this is actually in Australia, someone sent me this picture to show her on the set of a movie with waiting for her shot with a book there by her handbag. The book happened to be The Thinking Body by Mary Mabel Todd, which back in the old days, we were all required to read as an entrance requirement to getting into the Rolfe Institute. So as Rolfers, that was on our reading list. And Ida Rolfe counted it amongst her influences as well, about how we actually, the way we inhabit our bodies influences the movement, but also then the shapes and forms it expresses. So she was apparently a body person, Marilyn was. So we should see her walk though. We should see the results of her hard work on her walk. Yeah. Apparently had the desired effect, but there, yeah. So there's her hip shift, her exaggerated hip shift. And the results of that. So not that that's necessarily, obviously, what we're looking for. We're not looking for that much movement. Neither are we looking for John Wayne's lack of hip motion and instead compensating with his shoulders. We're looking for something in between those two. Oh yeah, this is an interesting one. I'm not sure it's gonna play well over Zoom. I have to experiment with that a bit more. So let me just show you the still pictures today. But this is a preview for a movie she did with Jane Russell, where they were cast opposite each other in this film as the blonde and the brunette. And the film was Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, 50s someplace. Sorry for not remembering the years. Must have been mid-50s. And in the plot line goes that basically Jane Russell, the brunette, had a boyfriend and Marilyn wanted him and she got him. So Gentlemen Prefer Blondes. That's the moral of the story, I guess. But in this contrasting roles, they were actually had contrasting not only hair colors, but also styles. So here's Marilyn shifting her hip way over that standing leg. Here's Jane shifting her shoulders instead. So they were, you know, one was a shoulder shifter, one was a hip shifter. So these kind of contrasting archetypes juxtaposed. It's interesting, as I was looking for the background, into looking for some background on Marilyn's walk and some ways that that showed up, one of the things I found out is that they made a sequel to this movie. Again, it faded into obscurity. They made a sequel to the movie Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, and the sequel was called Gentlemen Marry Brunettes. And it was starring Jane Russell. Marilyn didn't come back for that sequel, but Jane got her outcome, I guess. You know, she got married at least. Oh, I should say something else too. Interesting, probably opposite ends of the political spectrum as well. Marilyn had a well-known affiliation for liberals, while Jane Russell was the longtime lead of the Hollywood Christians Guild and fairly conservative politically as well. So I don't know if that correlates or not, but there you go. More contrasts. Okay, so here is an interesting study in human motion by Edward Muybridge from the 1870s. And at this time, you had to sit still for quite a long time to get a portrait of yourself. This kind of photography had never been done, where you could see a fast action photographs one after another, breaking the motion down into snapshots. And Edward Muybridge, the photographer, invented this camera to settle a bet, which is about whether or not a horse's feet leave the ground all at the same time or not. And this was a debate. And he was determined to capture a horse in mid-stride to show that. And for do that, he invented this machine that used multiple cameras. These are cameras that are triggered at different moments to take these multiple photographs in movement. And then once he proved his point that horses' feet actually do in full gallop leave the ground all at the same time, he used his invention to study human and animal movement. And there's a lot of well-known studies of his showing us things that had never been seen before and are still really useful and interesting studies of the human body and also of animal forms in motion. So for this one, of a woman walking down the stairs, we can actually stack them up in a GIF and animate them so that we can actually bring her back from the 1870s and see what that's like for her to walk down those steps and turn the corner. And then if we look at it from the other direction, we can analyze it in terms of hip shift. So here she is lifting her left knee. Here she is lifting her right knee. And, you know, just for the sake of illustrating it, we can draw a grid on it or a plumb line on it and see that makes it obvious that in this case, she's shifting her shoulder girdle more to the right than she does to the left. When she lifts up, unweights her left leg, her shoulder girdle shifts to the right than it does when she unweights the opposite side. In this case, when she unweights her right leg, it's more of her pelvic girdle shifting, or her whole torso shifts over that standing leg. Now, I'm not saying that that is necessarily a very good test for her. She's walking downstairs. She's turning a corner. You know, you can tell that she has different things going on in her body. She's holding one hand stiffer than the other. She's on camera without her clothes on, and it's 1874. All those things are factors in the analysis that we got to kind of correct for. They're all compounding variables. But just as illustrations here, we can see again, right shoulder shift, left hip shift. Okay, so any questions there we should catch up on, moderators? And feel free, this is a moment when if you got a question, you could raise your hand. Yeah, go ahead.
Could you co-host me? I think I gave it back to you.
Sure.
Thanks.
I have a question.
Go for it.
From John, my understanding is that when you shift, you have a weak glute complex. Mm-hmm. When it's weak, you drop your hip and shoulder. Question.
Yeah. Yeah. We're going to go dive into that in more detail next time. But that is the conventional interpretation of shift. That shift is seen to be a sign of weakness. I'm here to tell you that even guys can shift and not be weak. Okay? You can change your shift, so to speak, and not weakness is certainly one explanation or one interpretation, but it's also, you could also say it's the ability to adapt and adapt under control. But from a strength model, you'd look at to avoid the shift or avoid the drop. And we want the ability to do that, and then probably the ability not to do that when it's not called for as well.
And there's a question from Kyra. She's got her hand up.
Okay, go ahead, Kyra.
It's Kyra. Kyra. But yeah, I'm interested. I'm thinking of like a very specific client that I unfortunately don't see anymore, but thinking of what looks like a tilt, like a whole torso tilt versus a shift that ends up looking like more of the rib cage and the shoulders as a unit.
Can you show us in your body with standing? Can we see enough of you to do that standing?
So like kind of this versus a more of a translation, definitely exacerbated by being on one leg. So something that looks like it's a hinging here.
Yeah, and that's happening. What I'm looking for, is that happening while you're lifting your left leg? Is that when it happens?
I'm trying to remember when, because I've seen it posturally, just standing passively. So, but accompanying a weight distribution shift in the lower body too. But
that's, we're speculating a little bit since we can't see here and the memory's not that clear. The test really is a motion test, so we got to see her in motion as opposed to a static position. There could be lots of things involved in someone's shift over a standing leg and standing still. But the question is, what happens when she raises, say, in your case, her left knee? Let's assume that is like, as you showed us, when you left your left knee, you shift to the right, which is kind of like the Muybridge model on the screen does too, the same pattern. So I'm about to go through that. Hang with me there. And if that didn't clear it up, then come back with some questions. But thank you.
And Brian's got his hand up too.
I think I tried to unmute you, Brian. I'll unmute you, Brian. Here you go.
Okay. Hi, Till. Oh,
go right ahead.
Thank you for this. What about the quad group, especially vastus lateralis or IT band area? If that area is strong, doesn't that support the glute med in men in the shifting and help bolster kind of like a pylon in the ground to keep that whole weighted area stronger?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, I'm going to cook it down to some different structures. We'll go through those in turn, but quadriceps, lateral hamstrings, there's a, you know, all the way up and down the whole body, there's other things that are part of that pattern too. And I'm going to mention muscle names, but let's pretend that that's shorthand for a myofascial complex that involves more than just our conventional definition of the muscle. So I'll say more about that as we go to. Okay, back to our slideshow. And I'm actually gonna try a poll. And I'll give you the questions and then I'll poll you. Zoom has a poll feature that we're gonna try out today for the first time. The question is, if the shoulder girdle shifts more to the right than left with knee raise, that's what the model we just saw. If it shifts more to the right than the left with the knee raise, we'd work the lateral side of which hip? The left hip or the right hip? So if, again, someone's shoulder girdle shifts over the right, which hip are we going to work? If we're, what we're looking for is this idea of release or ability to lengthen under load. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to try the actual polling function. I'll launch the poll. And if I did it right, you'll see that come up on your screen and you can make your selection. So the someone's shoulder girdle shifts to the right. Given our model, what I've said so far in the lecture, which hip you gonna work? Shoulder girdle shifting to the right, good. Yeah, we got a got some good votes coming in. I don't know if you all can see the results, but I do, it's kind of cool. Yeah, it's kind of like live election results here coming in. Give it another couple seconds for you to make your vote, starting to stabilize, that's great. Yeah, so we got about 20% saying left, about 80% saying right. The rights have it, both in terms of the polling, but also in terms of our model. We're gonna say, yeah, it's the right hip. But let me go through that and make sure that that's clear to you as well. So I'm gonna stop my screen share and show you on camera where, if I'm doing this so you can see, is this the right for you? Give me a thumbs up if this is the right side because it gets kind of flipped around. Okay, good. So if my shoulders shift right, yeah, when I lift that leg, you know what? This is too confusing for me because it's totally mirrored around Zoom. Let me do it on the, sorry about that. Let me do it on the anatomical model. I think that's gonna be better. Silly. False start there. Okay, so back to the model. She shifts right over her, she's shoulder girdle right, we said. The question was, are we gonna work the right hip when she gets on her table or work the left hip? In our model, we're gonna work the right hip because that's the one that's not able to eccentrically lengthen under load. Say the lateral line or the abductors or the outside of the leg, perhaps lateral quads, perhaps lateral hamstrings, all those things that this is shorthand for, isn't lengthening as much as say this side does when she does the opposite. In this case, while she steps on this leg and lifts this one, her hip shifts and that means a lengthening along her left side. So this side gets longer compared to this side, which doesn't. And as a result, she has to move her shoulder over her right leg. Okay. So this is often the source of questions, and my dyslexia there didn't help, but I think I got it out coherently enough that if you didn't get it this first time, you can go back and play the recording, or you can talk about it in your small group, or you can go through and read the page in the handout too that'll talk you through it as well too. All right, so yeah, the results there, I'll look like I can share the results. We got 80% agreeing with me that it was the right hip we'd work, 20% still thinking the left. And again, there's arguments both ways, but in this model where we're looking for the Stork test as an indicator of the ability of the pelvis to shift, it was her right side that was not shifting, was not lengthening. Okay, on with the show. Pelvic differences between animals is interesting. This is a really old picture. It's really poor quality, but it's still worth showing how a gorilla's pelvis is so different from a human's in a number of ways. It's much bigger, but its largeness comes in its long dimension, not in its width, interestingly enough. This is an orangutan pelvis, similar. orangutan pelvis, very long, very narrow, yeah, compared to a human pelvis, which is shorter and wider. Some of these differences in pelvic shape, there's human again, so back to orangutan in human. Differences in pelvic shape means different kinds of leverage. So that if I have a wider pelvis, a wider, shorter pelvis, I have different angle of pull on all the structures attached along that iliac crest that give me essentially more stability in my hips. That because of that oblique angle, I can stabilize easier with my pelvis. If I have a narrow, long pelvis, then I got to actually move my shoulders to stabilize over the foot because they don't have the same leverage in the pelvis itself. That's why great apes really do the shoulder shifting. They do an exaggerated version of that John Wayne walk where they really shift the shoulders over each foot. Yeah. While us humans can shift our pelvis and with it the whole torso over the standing foot. These two pelvises, of course, are male and female human, with the female pelvis being much wider and typically shorter than the male pelvis. This is another type of biped pelvis. I'll give you a tour, and then if you have a guess as to what it is, again, if you've been in the class, you've heard me say it, but otherwise, chat it in. We'll see what guess, what kind of animal you think this is. But this pubic symphysis here, yeah, these are iliac crests. They flared really wide to get that stability over the standing legs. These are femurs. You need wide hips in order to stand over your leg. This animal does not have the same kind of shoulder girdle that we do, as apes and primates do. So it isn't able to use, say, its shoulder girdle in the same way to balance. So instead it flared its iliac crest out really wide. That's number one, to get the leverage for the muscles that attach down into the lower limb. And this structure right here is the sacrum. Yeah. Any guesses out there, moderators? Can you tell me what guesses?
Yeah, we have some good ones here. Whale, frog.
No, whales don't have femurs typically. These are femurs. Frogs do have femurs. This is not a frog. That's a good one, though.
Well, frogs, alien.
Bipeds. Yeah, alien could be. That's a good guess.
Till in yoga pose.
Yeah, I wish.
Stork.
Getting warmer.
Large flightless bird.
Yes.
Seal.
Seal, no.
And seal ostrich. Is not.
Yeah, ostrich. There we go. Seal doesn't qualify as a biped last time I checked, but ostrich. This is an ostrich pelvis. And it's showing how, as a large flightless bird, it had to use its light bones. Birds have typically pretty light bones with actually holes in them compared to mammals. So they have the scaffolding they need for movement and muscular attachment without the weight. So the ostrich flared its pelvis out evolutionarily to get that stability over the standing leg. Okay, so what we do then is we, after the stork test, after we determine which side of the hip isn't able to lengthen as much as the other one, because we do the stork test each side and we compare, then we lay our client down and start to play with those movements and those structures. Abductors here, where the goal, and you'll hear me talk about it on the video if you're doing that version of the course, the goal here is to help the client find movement without contracting there first. It's that simple. Can you move your knee without pushing me out? So it's a puzzle. It's a movement puzzle, and it means really slowing things down and coaching them towards that goal. It's probably technically impossible. It's probably technically impossible to move the knee without a little bit of contraction in your abductors, but it's a worthy endeavor to attempt that and to coach your client into that process as you go. So that's that one. What we're working with there, again, our medius minimus, abductors, and all the things that cross this thing, some of maximus for sure. So the really local level of what I'm working on there are these structures. These local structures here, which help control that hip shift, they're part of longer chains, as this classic illustration shows us how they're part of longer relationships that do, say, continue up the body, the side of the body, around the body, helping determine both span and movement possibility. Continuing that theme down the leg here with the iliotibial tract technique. So here it's just looking for adaptability and the ability of these things to slide. That gliding ability that, say, Wojtek was talking about in the Zoga class in the leg. And there's lots of ways to do it. You'll see a couple on the video, but there's lots of variations as well where you can have active movement, you can have passive. But the goal there is, can I help someone have the ability to eccentrically lengthen along that side, the side that they weren't able to shift towards? So there's an animation of abduction now and adduction and the iliotibial tract's role in that. Interestingly, the anatomical illustrations we have about the iliotibial tract don't really hold up when you get a really detailed study of its shape. And these guys are pretty good. This is Primal Pictures. These pictures have been around a little while now, but they actually modeled them on a human, and they show some cool ways that that iliotibial tract does cross the knee and help as a part of that stabilizing. What it doesn't show is that this iliotibial tract actually goes deep and attaches to the bone all the way through. So it's not just a strap along the outside of your leg. It's a septum that dives deep into the leg and is anchored to the bone all along its length. But again, it's also very sensitive, as you know, especially down toward this distal end. Lots of mechanoreceptors there. So part of what we're doing when we work it is waking it up and helping someone get a clearer or a more refined signal that they can use in weight shift and balance over the standing foot. Now, part of that pattern too is what's happening on the inside. So the adductors, adductors on the inside need to be able to eccentrically respond, be able to lengthen, and they also need to stabilize as a part of that weight shift too. So while the outside of the hip is lengthening, the inside are contracting or stabilizing, and that's that reciprocal relationship of AB to adductors that we're waking up and refining and making clear. That's how they're both involved in this story. So this is just a cool diagram showing that, yeah, when you swing your leg out, you know, abduct, the adductors need to eccentrically lengthen. And when you do the opposite, it's the abductors on the outside of the hip that need to lengthen too. If you can imagine this foot planted on the ground, that hip needs to shift, or for that hip to shift this way to her right, this side needs to lengthen all the way down from the tibia all the way up to the ear bone. That whole side needs to lengthen to let that hip shift to the right. More pictures of that iliotibial arrangement. These are drawn from actual cadavers in this case. So they're probably a little more true to life. A lot to say about iliotibial tract and how it's part of the wrappings around the whole leg, as well as being feathered into so many structures up above and down below. And about this little zone here, local abductor zone, where there's lots of bursa that sandwich the different structures there. They're variable, individual to individual, about how many you have and where they are and if they're separate or conjoined. But bursa, as we know, are really important for the gliding, for the actual sliding of one thing over the other when we're moving. And if they get bruised or they're not able to slide or injured somehow, they can get inflamed either through mechanical means or other inflammatory mechanisms. And if they get inflamed, they often are painful and sensitive. So sometimes the shift of the shoulders instead of the hips is an attempt to avoid a painful spot. So it's posture again as a defense as opposed to posture as a defect. We're really moving around something that's painful. Or sometimes you'll have people report, I can't sleep on my side because my hip just hurts too much. Sometimes that's a bursa sensitivity, or maybe perhaps some of these insertional tendon sensitivities where they're hypersensitized, and that just gets difficult when you put weight right on it. So this kind of work might be something I would try to see if that can shift that kind of sensitivity going on there. The next phase of the work, we're actually looking at the septa of the thigh. The septa of the thigh. So we are going to take a movement break in a little bit here, but I got a few more pictures to show you. Yeah, we should do this first before we take a movement break. The septa are the separations between these bundles. This is Jeff Lynn in the Visible Human Project showing us how these soft tissues, the muscles of the leg, in this case, are separated by septa, which are also gliding surfaces. You can think of them as sections in an orange where they separate, or you can think about them as lubricating interfaces that allow the whole thing to move and shift and slide as it does. And here, the deepest myofascial structures are shown are when on the right and the sleeves around those on the left. So those outer layers, that fascia crurus and the fascia around the leg, including, in this case, iliotibial tract, and you can see here how deep that dives, is part of what needs to slide as well. So a lot of that's sliding both within layers, but also for sleeve around the core of the limb. Now, down to what's happening within the limb, these are, this is a drawing from Borgeri, 150-year-old drawings showing us the septa between the different muscles, myofascial units of the leg. There's sciatic nerve, interestingly. It's embedded in some of the thickest zone of septa. Hamstrings, adductors, quadriceps, etc., are right around the femur. Within this interstitial wrapping of the superficial fascia and skin, it's all these things.
When you look closer, you can see that just below the dermis.
I'm sorry, sorry for the sound, I'm turning that off. This is Jean-Claude Guimbertot. He's showing us under an arm, when you lift up those surface layers, you can see the sliding qualities of these tissues, how they're gushy. They change shape when you pull them up. Now, in this case, he's lifted up not only the skin, but now he's lifting up some of the deeper layers too, so that you can see what looks like spaces between those. The spaces aren't there when it's all together. As air spaces, they're there as fluid spaces in a unopened body. But these kind of things are happening within those fluid layers. These are the layers that have been recently referred to as the interstitium. This is superficial fascia. And so many fluids here and so much movement and so much dynamic interplay between the different shapes and structures. If you don't know Jean-Claude Guimbertot's Strolling Beneath the Skin video, go look for it on YouTube and you can see all kinds of really cool images of what's going on right under our skin. And then he has a few more of deeper structures in the body too. But that's essentially what we're working with when we do our work, and it's what's happening when we move. It's what's happening whenever we say walk or kick a soccer ball or stand over a leg. All of these surfaces need to slide. So that's what we're looking for in the differentiation phase of our work. Here in this technique, I'm thinking for those septa and feeling them and using active client movement to get some more gliding along their interfaces. I'm not squishing the adductors against the bone. In this case, in the top picture, I'm more pulling the hamstrings off of those and having someone move. In the lower picture, I'm pulling the quadriceps the other way to help the body find, to help the brain feel that division there. And then active movement helps the brain register the potential for movement there, and then also helps the differentiation and sliding get restored. Just a cool illustration of those distinctions and those bundles. Here's Leonardo making a little schematic for himself, showing the distinctions and divisions within the leg. He's saying, where do the muscles pull? What are the lines of pull there? And you can see there's a bunch along the attachments. There's some of these abductors we've been talking about. There's these adductors. And interestingly, a lot of the adductors attach along the ramus. This is the medial side now of the pelvis. Hamstrings here on ischial tuberosity and ramus of the pelvis there. So now it's about time for your ball. Yeah, I'm going to leave this picture up here. I'm going to have you get your ball. And so get your ball and get your towel if you need it. And actually, Let's do this. I'm not going to leave the picture up there. I'm going to show you. I'm going to get on your screen. I'm going to show you what I have in mind here. You're going to make yourself with your towel, let's say if you need it, a little nest on your chair. And in this little nest, you're going to try a ball. Yeah, maybe it's a tennis ball. Maybe you got a bigger, softer one. Maybe you have some variations. But it's going to be a little bit of trial and error. But you're going to get that set up on your nest. You're going to lay the egg there. And then you're going to sit on your egg. Yeah? So this is the mother hen experiment. Now, if your towel's too soft or your chair's too soft, you won't be able to feel the egg at all. It just gets lost in all the squish. If the ball's too hard or your chair's too hard, you're going to be suffering. And we're going to be able to tell in gallery view, you know, that your ball is too hard by the facial expressions we see from that. So work with it, you know, different folds of the towel, different balls perhaps. Like I got this big softball, I got a tennis ball. I actually have a really hard chair, you know, so I got to get it just right for myself. But basically, you're going to find a way to sit on your egg in your nest there that helps you feel those bones. Okay, so now I'm going back to the screen share. You're going to just kind of sit on that egg and let it gestate, you know, just imagine all those good things that happen as you sit on your egg. And as you do that, you can breathe. That's an important part of it. Breathe and settle, because what your egg is doing there is it's pressing, if you got it right, it's pressing on these different attachments on the bone. You can rock your pelvis a little bit to feel that. You can feel how, again, don't grind your bones into the egg. It's not good for anybody. But you're just using the egg to stimulate a little bit of sensation there where you can feel where there's actually attachments there. Yeah. So these attachments all along those bones are the structures that fan down into your leg. Yeah. So the adductors there on the inside of your leg really do attach along this ramus. And then you're also feeling for sure your pelvic floor attachments. So the structures that span that diamond-shaped opening at the bottom of your pelvis. So you're feeling how the ball can press along these structures here. Sacrotuberous ligament, which we were working on last time. If you work up against the edge of one bone, if your ball's small enough and clear enough, you can feel one sit bone. If you roll over on one side, you can feel how sacrotuberous ligament is a little bit softer if you roll forward so that your ball is pressing into the backside. Or if you go forward, you'll feel more of the attachments of adductors along the ramus. If you let the ball just sink into the pelvic floor, into the whole space, the ball is, if that's not too uncomfortable, then you get a sense of the pelvic floor, how you can actually take a big breath and exhale and let yourself settle onto the egg a little more. Again, don't do it if it's too painful. It means you got the wrong nest or wrong egg or something. It's not about pain. It's about waking up. It's about awareness, about alive, becoming more alive there. So I'm going to let you breathe a little bit while I get a drink of water. Shifting. Just take your own time with that. And if you've had enough of the egg, go ahead and let it hatch and fly the coop. I'm going to grab a cough drop while you ask a question or two as you come off your ball. But go right ahead and ask your question. Raise your hand and then Claire will unmute you.
Hi, Till. I have a question. On the adductor sheet B06, your note says, be sure to work psoas M after working adductors.
Yeah, that comes from our structural inner integration tradition where we were, at least at the time that I trained, that was drilled into us. If you're going to work if you're going to work the other way around, if you're going to work the 80 doctors, you got to work so as. In that model, it was within a week or so. And that was just conventional wisdom was that if you didn't do that, people would tend to have a low back ache. You know, you basically mobilized things below the pelvis, and unless you do something that helps mobilize above the pelvis, then people could have some discomfort in their low back. And sure enough, I don't know if it was the, power suggestion or what, but the times that I tried that, I did see that for myself and for clients. So that made it into the notebook. Now, we're going to do that toward the end of the sequence. We're actually going to include the psoas in this sequence to accomplish that. I think the larger principle there is don't get so tunnel vision that you're just thinking like just below and just the hip joint, that you're still back in the big picture.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
And there's a question from Brian as well.
Go ahead, Brian.
Yes. How important is the core, especially internal and external obliques? Because I know a rectus abdominis isn't as structurally important as maybe internal and external obliques. So how important are those in the deviation of the shoulder and pelvis in walking or stepping down those stairs, like with that model?
Yeah, that's going to be even more apparent, I think, next lecture. This time we're focusing on, say, hip, joint, and leg relations, hip to pelvis relationships. Next time we're going to talk about, say, pelvis up into spine relationships, and that'll get even more important. Thank you, Brian. Okay, so my voice is back, more or less. Let's go back to the screen share so that we can talk about those upcoming techniques. Stay comfortable. Keep moving. Yeah, if you didn't hear, yeah, your egg is probably out by now, but just do what you need to do with your egg, etc. In this technique, we're working for the hamstring origins, the insertions on that ischial tuberosity. Thinking Golgi response again, it tends to be static from my side, but then from the pelvis side, you can see I'm coaching her there with my hand a little bit. She's doing some pelvic rocking or some knee flexion with the idea that that's eliciting a Golgi response in the hamstrings. Hamstrings are built for heavy duty application. They do a lot in our body. And that's why it feels sometimes like they're so tough and don't yield. Hamstring injuries are actually the second most common amateur athletic injury. Yeah, second most common. If you're not muted out there, somebody could mute yourself, or maybe Bruce will get after you. Yeah, thank you. So second most common athletic injury, the most common one is ankle injuries, as you could probably guess, but hamstrings are really common. Hamstring injuries are really common. Some of that might be the lack of adaptability they have. This is a hamstring tear where they this tendon tore away from the bone, bled out into the tissue and caused this more opaque tissue on the image. So that's the scarring, essentially scarring of the connective tissue from a tear and an injury there. So working, one more picture. Vegetarians, this is a turkey thigh showing turkey hamstrings and all the tendons within the turkey hamstring. Sometimes these tendon turkeys ossify. They get little pinnate bones or a little bit of calcification within these tendons. Those are the bones that you pick out of your drumstick on Thanksgiving. So that lack of adaptability or that hardness that can happen there in the hamstrings is actually functional. We want them to be springy. We want them to be tough. We want them to load and to support our body weight. They do that. They don't want them to be just stretchy rubber bands. We do want them, however, to have the capacity to relax and contract as needed. We want that full range of neurological control. And that's what we're after with the Golgi work, right up on those hamstring attachments there. Right up there is where I'm working, right where you had your egg probably at one point pressing on your ramus. This picture too shows a great example of how all of those adductors are arrayed along the ramus of the pelvis. And so what we're going to do in the sequence is we actually, explain the context, get permission, we drape people appropriately, then we lay them on their side so that we have access to the in the interior aspect of the leg, the adductor aspect of the leg, then we work right up around that ramus. And this position here allows us to really get access that we wouldn't get otherwise. So adductors are rarely worked in a lot of different kinds of body work. They're super important in stabilization. These guys, these sumo wrestlers, are using them to stabilize and throw each other off balance. My son recently strained his adductors, not sumo wrestling, but skiing on a rail going sideways, where he actually, as you can imagine, sideways along a rail, if you haven't seen the skiers do that, they're sliding sideways, has to stabilize sideways, so he's controlling hip shift. And that just strained him, was too ambitious with that or something. So here's the technique I would do with him. I would explain it to him first, and he would, he'd say, yeah. But in fact, he was remote at that point. He wasn't here with me, so I was explaining to, giving him some ideas about how to do this with himself, where we're actually lined up in an appropriately draped and contextualized client, lined up with the ramus, with the forearm, pressing on the bone. I think there's some good illustrations on the technique video here on your little video there. Essentially, my elbow is lined up with the ramus there. I can rock around and feel it. It's going to be easier for you to see on the video than here, but that's essentially what I'm doing. I'm feeling for the whole span of that ramus, all of the adductors that are there on that. So I'm getting their Golgi apparatuses all at once along that bony rim. And then I wait for that response. This picture is actually showing us those attachment points, but it's showing us the septa too that we're working with earlier in the adductor technique. These are some great pictures of those fascial compartments on the inside of the leg. The obturator internus technique on B9, I've switched arms, and again, with the right context, level of rapport and the clear indication, the client knows why I'm doing this and I'm staying in careful contact with them. I'm actually gonna, let me get my other pelvis here to show this one. I'm gonna orient around the ischial tuberosity, and then I'm gonna just come up medially a little bit with my elbow, and that puts me into the obturator internus fossa, where that structure attaches and does some really cool things there. I mean, one of the cool things is that's, again, where the Golgi tendon organs are concentrated on its attachment on the bone. So even though internus comes all the way out here to the trochanter, we're getting its full length by just working right there on the medial side of that ramus. The elbow is kind of counterintuitively less invasive for a lot of people than fingers. We learned it as, structural integration students with our fingers there. That can get very accurate. It can be more pokey, So the elbow tends to be actually broader and easier to accommodate. It's kind of like just a really nice soft ball like you had there. But then I'll actually have, I'll roll the femur and things like that to get positioned on that lake. And I suggest that when it comes time for you to practice it, you actually get not only this picture in the book out, but get a picture of the anatomy there. And then practice it, if you haven't done this work before already, practice it with a friend who can guide you and say, yeah, that's right. Because although it's pretty close to the privates, it shouldn't be anywhere too close. It actually feels a lot less invasive to the person on the table than it might to you. So that's where we're working. We're working right inside the ramus there, up on the medial side. That's obturator internus attachments along that fossa. And again, it's having effects on that whole stabilizing structure. And you can imagine that when both of these are contracting and relaxing together, they're helping control pelvic shift as well. They're helping either pull the pelvis forward in space or allowing it to go backwards, which is a movement we do with walking as well. So they're engaged as a pair in that kind of negotiation of front-back balance as well. Orange here, sacral tuberous ligament. We had a good time with that last sequence, and it's just, we're not working with directly here, but it's good to know where we are. We're again working obturator fossa here, obturator fascia as well. That's where the adductors are. It's a great view of those adductors and their Golgi concentrations all along that bone. hamstring insertions, etc., obturator internus, which in a real body is covered with fascia that's been taken away here. You can see obturator internus here, fanning out toward the thigh, hamstring insertions where I'm leaning with my elbow, Golgi tendon concentrations of these tendinous areas along the ramus of the pelvis. And lots of movements there we can do. Rotation will allow us to feel obturator, to know we're on it, having someone passively or actively rotate their leg while we're there with our elbow will allow us to confirm, yeah, that's obturator muscle, and then it's fascia over that is what we're interested in as well. The obturator is the attachment point for the pelvic floor, for the lateral side of the pelvic floor. This is a picture of a sacrum and some ilia where the obturator would be, and two babies, these are twins, inside mom. So that ends up being a very important part of the anatomy as we go into birth and needs to accommodate that process of the baby coming through. So that this zone here, we're just medial to the ramus, is where the obturator internus is, and that serves as an attachment point for those structures that comprise the pelvic floor. This is where your ball was. That was where your egg was for sure. On a male, it's a little different. Same structure, but you have prostate there. You have the roots of the genitals arranged differently. But that's the zone we're talking about on a male as well. Wax models of the pelvis floor. Here's where, this is from below now. There's coccyx. There's ischial tuberosities. The funnel-shaped array of the pelvic floor muscles attach all along this inner wall here where the obturator internus was. That's where we were with their elbow. Sacrotuberous ligaments have been removed from this this model, but they'll be right there. And then from above, the funnel of the pelvic floor being suspended from the coccyx and from the obturator fascia here along the sides and from all along the inside, that deepest bowl of the pelvis. This is from the fascial plastination project showing pelvic floor from above. This is one that I put up on the Facebook post to see if you could guess where we were. There's obturator internus. There's that edge of pelvic floor where it attaches onto the obturator internus fascia on both sides. So our elbow will be just below this, just below all this view. This is from above, bird's eye view of the pelvic floor from above. Okay, I just want to show you now from below how that idea that you're not, you can, if done right in the right context, it shouldn't be invasive. You're actually pretty far from privates. And here, just to get you oriented, these are ischial tuberosities. The orange here is sacral tuberous ligament. All these little threads here are nerves. Some of this would be sciatic nerve, others would be cutaneous nerves, which is why it's so sensitive when we work around here. I'm going to go ahead and take away the fig leaf. Yeah, so you can see that while you're working out here on the attachments and on the obturator, you're actually pretty far from any privates, as a couple inches at least in an adult, sometimes more. And so you want to make sure you're not, it's not invasive feeling, but you can reassure yourself that you're actually not, anywhere that's going to cause someone to feel like you're getting too intimate or too close. And this is just a little anatomical humor. Hello, obturator. She's talking right to it there. Of course, all this is relevant for sitting. There you are sitting on your chair, perhaps listening to me. So while you're doing that there, just rock a bit and feel how those sit bones and ramus are some of the structures you sit on as well. And that has effects, of course, all the way up and down the body. Finishing our sequence, we've moved now into the final phase of the B sequence. The integration phase is about larger connections, about putting things together, about helping someone realize I'm not just that part of my body, I am a whole. So there's lots of ways to do that. In this one, this technique here, the psoas and iliacus from the side, from the lateral part of the body, is kind of a bookmark in our sequence to say, yeah, do something that connects it upwards. And I'm honoring that tradition of making sure to do that after some adductor work that we learned as structural integrators way back when. So here, I won't try to explain the technique. You'll see it on the video if you're doing that, but it's basically sneaking in behind the viscera to the lateral aspects of those structures. Again, with the intention, not so much of scraping them or stretching them or even releasing them per se, but more at this phase, it's more of a gentle touch and more of connecting, and actually do employ active movement there to get my client to feel, be able to feel how the leg is actually connected on up into the spine. And that's like pointing as an indicator where our next session will likely focus, which is above the pelvis up into the spine. So connection there is the goal, a sensation of connection, sensation of how the leg is connected to the spine, and movement does involve the spine. That's the purpose of that technique, and that's how I know that I've done my work there. So this is the fascia around the iliacus and psoas complex. I'm sneaking in around it from with a gentle touch from behind and just finding the psoas, having someone actively move so that they can feel how, wow, the leg comes all the way up here into the low back. Doing something nice now just for the rest of the body. Again, this is kind of a bookmark to say, this technique, the mother cat, to say, do something else too in the body. In this case, up at the upper end of the spine. The hand is wrapping around the neck. This is a better picture of showing how it's actually the outer layers of the neck that I'm drawing backwards. This is one of Moshe Feldenkrais's techniques. He did this to prepare his clients, he said, for the work. He'd spend at least 10 minutes, he said, on every client doing this one technique, milking the neck, getting them to relax and settle in an autonomic shift while he was getting ready for his functional integration work as well. But it's a lot like the name comes from what a mother cat does as she picks her kittens up. Yeah, picking them up from the scruff of the neck in a way. So there's more about what I talked about in volume one. And, you know, I apologize, in the suggested materials for the course, we listed volume one, we did not list volume two, but there are a couple things to read in volume two if you want, completely optional. I've covered the bulk of it. You'll be fine if you don't have it. But if you do have a volume two or you want to get it, then the references are included in this week's home study, including some of the things we'll be doing next time. We're going to get, as I said, into the pelvis and above next time. So the volume two gives you a cool preview of some of that. And those references are in your home study readings. And then I realized too, there's a chapter I wrote for Eric Dalton for his book he did a few years ago, Dynamic Body, that talks about that hip shift thing and has, again, Sarah Reinerston's picture. That's the one she gave me permission to reprint. And talks about that pattern in a detailed way. So if you have this book, go check that chapter out. There's a check to reference in the notes. It's not a cheap book. I think we sell it for about $90 on our site. I think you can get it on Amazon for a similar price. So it's not a required text, but it's a great overview of how all these different teachers are seeing the question of walking. He said, write me something about walking and I'll put it all together in a book. And so that's what a lot of us did. Check out the techniques themselves in the pelvis DVD or online video. That's the one where you're going to see the actual techniques. Or take these ideas and use them in what you do already. Start to play with differentiation, play with this kind of sequencing or these kind of intentions or that Golgi effect, etc. And then check out the home study as well. That's going to have, I'm going to invite the same thing. Do some of this as movement for yourself. Same thing we did last time, which is you take one of these techniques, get inspired by the picture or what you see in the video or what I've said, and turn it into a self-care technique or a dance move or a yoga asana where it's actually something you can play with yourself. And feel free to reuse the mother hen, but you can also come up with a lot of other options there as well. We have launched a couple of feedback pages there. If you want to come in and give us anonymous or private feedback, that's a great way to do it. We've been getting some great emails too and a couple comments in the Facebook group. But there's a official way you can submit feedback if you want to. And those are linked in the email you'll be getting with your home study and in the course navigator. So while we're finishing up, actually, now let me go ahead and finish up the rest of the slides. That's Kiva. Go check it out. I'll put the link in the hand. No, not in the handouts. I can't do that. But I can put it on the Facebook page, bit.ly/Kiva-hands-on. Whether you think you might want to borrow or lend, it's a great way to pair that up and help people through hard times all over the world in all sorts of different situations. Another plug for our Zoga class with Wojtek Gakowski. He's doing the same sequence, but he's doing it in movement. His background is as an anatomy trains instructor for Tom Myers, but then also he's a physical therapist in Poland who's come up with his own system of movement, yoga-inspired movement exercises that he's customizing for our sequence here. So it's a great opportunity to work with him, and I'm really thrilled by what he's bringing us as practitioners for our own bodies, but then also what we can apply to our clients. All right. You have made it through the slideshow. We still have some time. That's awesome. We can open it up now. So if you, I'm going to go ahead and stop the screen share. If you have a question, go ahead and raise your hand. Brian, I'm going to wait on you because we've had a couple questions from you already. So let's see if others have questions they want to do. And Nikki or anybody else, if you see some in the chat, yep, you think is a good time, go for it.
I have a couple here. Will the video of the first Zoga session be available?
Yeah. It's been posted already in the Facebook group. If you're not in the principal's Facebook group, but in the Zoga Facebook group, it has been posted there. And it's also going to be emailed out, I think, as an email link. If you're not in that Facebook group but are in the Zoga class, you'll get that as an email later. But yeah, that's the purpose. We're generating recordings of Wojtek doing his work, and then he and I dialoguing about it a little bit for you to go back to later. I've done things with Wojtek a few times and really excited by it, but the guy is so knowledgeable and his mind works so fast that it's a little hard for me to keep up. I'm like half again his age as well. So what I wanted to do was get him on recording so that I could push pause and go back and replay it and hear it again. But that's really the purpose of this thing we're doing with him, is to generate some recordings. What else you got, Nikki?
There's a concern that there might be homework beyond volume one of your book.
Yeah, no. I mean, there's suggested references you can go look up. The homework is completely supplementary. So again, apologies that I just now realized that there's some good stuff in volume two to read too, but it's not at all homework in the sense of something you need to do to get credit or to pass or even to get good stuff out of this course. It's more like a little, you know, if you want to go learn even more, go check that out.
Pubic synthesis distortion thoughts.
Yes. This was, remind me who that was, the asker of the question. Was that David?
David,
yeah. Yeah. I'm thinking options for movement, that's my goal, and refined proprioception. I'm not saying that's the only thing that's important. I'm saying that really helps me focus what is most effective, what I find to be most effective and what I find to be most important in my approach. Now, I worked for a long time from a shape model or a positional model that would look at things like, you said the word distortion, the idea that there's a normal shape to things and that if it's different, then it would be distorted. I don't use that language so much anymore, and I don't use that model so much anymore. David, feel free to unmute yourself and jump in if you want to extrapolate it all. But I'm not assessing, at least in my approach, I'm not assessing by shape as much as I am by movement. So we do have ways that we are working with that in our ILIA class, which is essentially like the continuation of what I'm starting with you here, but we do it from a functional or a movement perspective more than a shape perspective. Go ahead, David. Okay. I see that you're unmuted.
No, thank you. I use the word distortion just because text is not a subtle, subtle form of communication. So it's just trying to communicate the idea that in my practice, I've seen a lot of people with chronic SI problems.
Yeah.
And what seems to be the unaddressed component for many of them is the soft tissue imbalance, which leads to that distortion. And that distortion I've seen come out in either urinary tract issues, that UTIs that are not UTIs, incontinence issues. And also, obviously, with the client's permission, pain upon palpation, either them palpating or, and then from that point,
so depending on where the, sorry, David, I'm sorry. Your question?
My question is how do you relate what you've been teaching regarding the lower body work into how it affects the tensional balance and movement options on the pubic symphysis?
Yeah. The short answer is all connected, and all of these things that we're working with are connected in direct anatomical ways that you can chart in a muscle point of view, but certainly in a fascial point of view, all the connections there. And then the sensei quality in the brain is probably even more connected than any of those. The brain really doesn't distinguish really accurately between pubic symphysis and adductor. They're part of the same neurological arborization that develops embryologically. So our brain is talking to all that as a group. Yeah.
Okay.
Now,
thank you.
Yeah, no, stay with the question, and I think it's going to unfold too, but I bet you're going to have more wondering about that, because it was hard for me to switch from thinking about position to thinking about movement. And when I do start to think about movement and feel for movement, then it ends up handling a lot of those things that you described, and the things that I was also trying to address through the positional model that I don't think about it so much anymore. I'm going to go ahead and mute you, David. Any other, Kira, I don't remember if it's Kira or Kyra. I'm going to unmute you. Go ahead. What is it again? Third time you've told me?
It's Kira.
Kira, sorry.
No worries at all. So I noticed this both with using the ball on myself and clients, mm-hmm. that I feel like a lot of the direct pressure can create more sensitization. And sometimes I'm not sure if then we move to a different technique, if we don't want to do, tendon GTO work, or if it's just simply that you didn't hold on to it long enough for that release, and then it's caught in this kind of, like, it wants to do this spasm release, but it's just caught in spasm, or if you just came at it from a wrong angle. But oftentimes when I use a ball on myself, I end up having sensitized my own.
Yeah.
So.
Sensitized sounds bad, and it can be. Our goal in some ways is to sensitize, meaning we want it to be more refined. We don't want that to be unpleasant, you know? We don't want a sensitivity that I'm actually disturbed by or feel like I have to protect from or I think of as a bad thing. That's what makes the difference between a helpful sensation and an unhelpful one, really. And it's a lot of it's what we mentioned before, I think. It's like, it's a question of grading and a question of adapting. Because often if it's too intense, you can be sore afterwards. And you can avoid that soreness if that soreness seems like a bad thing. You could avoid that soreness with a softer ball, you know, or a smaller ball or a softer seat or less time on it, less aggressive approach. And the same with our touch. We wake things up in a way that they can be sensitive later. The times in my mind that that's a problem is when that's a problem for the client. When they feel like they've been bruised, we don't want that. Or when they're... when they don't feel like it's helpful, then we don't want that either. Robert Schleit made an interesting distinction yesterday on a webinar I was on between, how did he put it? can you exhale slowly, he said, or is it a quick with the sensation? So it's basically, what's your autonomic orientation toward the sensation? And that's another one to track. It's like, can you open into the sensation, which... when you can do that, it's usually not pain anymore. Pain is almost by definition a withdrawal or a protection around the sensation. So there's a whole lot more to say. We're just getting started on that topic. Because I'm not saying you should be sore. I'm not saying you shouldn't. I'm saying what I'm tracking is something else, which is the amount of disturbance that it leaves in its wake. And then the levers we have are how much pressure and how long, and really, I tend to be cautious, especially in this area. There are some nerves here that you do not want to be poking on with your elbow. If you try this at home, that's the idea of it. You go try this at home. Don't do anything that feels nervy or sharp or burny. That's like, don't do that, because there you could bruise a nerve. You could irritate a nerve all here along the inside of that ramus. You got to go kind of far, but anatomy is variable. So it's not about any kind of nervy sensation. There's a different kind of sensation that the Golgi tendons engender and things like that, where it's more of a softening and relaxing. All right. Looks like we got time, Brian, for a quick, you got one more hand up, Brian. You got a quick question for me. What you got, Brian? I got you unmuted.
Okay, thanks. Yeah. As a massage therapist for the last 5 years, but a certified running coach for over 20, you know, I look at the way you do stuff and you get people's proprioception going by, you know, working the muscle. But as a running coach, I get people to, I demonstrate proper running form and have them demonstrate it. So it's not only affecting the tissue, but getting them to move mechanically more efficient. Would you agree that's a good way to do it? Not only affecting the tissue, but getting them to retrain in dynamic.
Absolutely. Motion? Absolutely. The idea that we can just do something on the table and send them out and they're all different and all better. It's wonderful when that happens. It happens an amazing amount of the time. But overall, the more we can give people that they can take out in their life and use, we're going to amplify our effects. We're going to amplify that. So having the skills as a coach or as a conditioning person or as a movement therapist or as a walker, all those kinds of things are so important. Thank you, Brian. I'm going to go ahead and mute you and lower your hand. All right. Anything else in the chat we should catch up on, moderators, before we sign off for the day? Yeah.
Yeah, Till. Could we just have some clarity around if people are asking if they need to, can they just join the same small group or do they need to re-sign up for a new group every week? How is that working?
That's great. There is an email going out soon. It might be today, it might be tomorrow morning. You're going to get an email that says, okay, now it's time to schedule your next small group. That's also going to be posted in the Facebook group. Now you're going to go there and see something like you did last time. You're going to see a bunch of openings, except for the few people that came in later and didn't see so many openings. You're going to see a bunch of options and you can pick. Now we do suggest staying with the same group because that gives you some continuity with each other. You get to know each other and you get to hear how the work landed, but it's still open scheduling at this point. You get to pick which time and place you want to go. It's a bit of a shell game with the faculty, meaning you don't know what teacher you're going to get, but we are suggesting you stay with the same time more or less, but feel free to adapt it as you need to for your schedule. And just a reminder, only one of those small groups is required for credit. You're welcome at any of their space in. And if you ever do have trouble getting in, just check back because there's people regularly canceled. Thank you for the people that did cancel and couldn't come in. A reminder that if you didn't make it, please do cancel your reservation because there's people that are waiting to get into your slot. And Carmen's reminding us the Spanish group is pretty open. So if you want to debrief in Spanish, go join Carmen. Yes. Okay. Anything else, Nikki, you want to mention? Open it up to the rest of the faculty too.
A lot of goodbyes and thank you very much. There's a lot of appreciation. Cool. Looks like all the questions, as I can see, have been answered.
Nice. We'll be keeping active on Facebook for your ongoing conversations. We'll keep answering your emails if you want to do it that way. And then especially in those small groups, come join us for a small group as you go. Faculty, going once, going twice. Anybody want to say anything? Faculty, go for it, Larry.
If they need credit, CE credit, they need to go back to the course material and check it off just to make sure people know that.
We're going to give you an orientation on that. Don't worry about it for now. What Larry said is absolutely true. And that's available to you if you found your way to that already. It's gone out in a link. But if you don't know what he's talking about, don't worry about it. We're going to give you an orientation to making sure you check off your credit requirements. It's pretty easy. Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Anything else? Thank you all. A huge thanks to you guys for coming, but especially again for the team who's behind this all. I'm going to forget some if I try to name them all. Nikki for reading those out. Claire for raising and lowering hands, letting people in. Lorraine for being on our controls. She was actually piloting the airplane today, as well as Larry and Chris and Bruce who were there ready to jump in on the lecture. Bethany as well doing her work. Carmen on her work. Tiffany in our office, etc. So thank you, everybody. Be in touch. We'll see you in a week here and everywhere else in between. See you later.